From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the crisis in Libya as the UN is set to meet on the issue. We'll examine a new face in warfare.
Guerrillas organized as a virtual network. They don't have to see each other. They don't have to be in the same group or even in the same city.
The Thailand tourism sector pins hopes on upscale visitors. And the Indian Prime Minister vows to ensure religious freedom. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The UN Security Council holds an emergency meeting today on the security situation in Libya, following the release of a video Sunday showing the mass beheadings of Egyptian Christians by militants of the Islamic State in Libya. The Egyptian government, which launched airstrikes in retaliation, has called for a Security Council resolution aimed at international military intervention. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi told France's Europe One radio Tuesday, the 2011 NATO air campaign launched to aid rebels seeking to oust dictator Muammar Gaddafi represented an unfinished mission. He said, "We abandoned the Libyan people as prisoners to extremist militia once Gaddafi was removed and killed." Tuesday, the United States joined five European countries in condemning all acts of terrorism in Libya, saying it underscores the urgent need for a political resolution to the conflict in Libya. It says a UN-sponsored process to establish a national unity government is the best hope for Libyans to address the terrorist threat and confront the violence and instability that impedes Libya's political transition and development. Ian Lustig, a political science professor and Mideast analyst at the University of Pennsylvania, tells VOA's Victor Beatty there is no military solution to the Libyan conflict.
One thing I don't think they're going to be able to do is get a resolution that will approve any kind of UN military intervention in Libya. That's something that the Russians will just not allow, and I don't think that you'll find the British or the EU very interested in engaging in it either, though I understand France has been in contact with Egypt. I think we have to step back for a minute and not plunge immediately into what always seems to be most interesting in these situations, which is exactly what kind of military action will or will not take place, and see that the way that the local players, in this case Sisi and Egypt, are in a position to wag the dog, to use something that they know the world cares about tremendously, namely the ISIS threat to Europe, and to position Egypt in the front lines of what they would see as a renewed war on terror, in which Sisi's own problems in Egypt can be solved because he could get lots of money and political support from the West. That's what's on his mind, in addition to whatever specific threats there are in Egypt. So I think we have to be careful about being manipulated by the Egyptians in this case.
There was a joint statement released by the governments of the U.S., France, Italy, Germany, Spain, the United Kingdom, strongly condemned the acts of terror in Libya, underscores what they say is, quote, the urgent need for a political resolution to the conflict in Libya. As you probably know, that there are UN-mediated indirect talks among the various factions in Libya. Is that the best way to go?
There is no really good way to go, and that's the best one. But I am one of those observers that doesn't hold very high hopes for UN-mediated talks in Libya. If they couldn't work in Syria very well, in Libya the situation is much, much more difficult. There is no Libyan state anymore. You have two rival governments, three or four sections of the country that could split apart, tribes and militias galore throughout the country. We succumb to a temptation to help one side win the war, namely the anti-Qaddafists. We broke Libya without putting enough resources into it afterwards to try to fix it. And I think that's what the administration is regretting now, walking away too soon after NATO went in and produced what Qaddafi predicted. He said, "You will get rid of me and there will be hell here. There'll be chaos." And that's because he purposely arranged it that way. And there was no real state in Libya. Now, that's something which was not taken seriously by the West when it pushed ahead in Libya. Now, in a world that's even messier, where the Russians have reasons in Ukraine to keep us tied down, busy, and aggravated in North Africa and in the Middle and in the Levant, we have even fewer resources in terms of the UN. Yes, we have UN mediators, but no hope, really, I think, of UN-approved intervention.
Lustig suggests the likely future of Libya is partition between East and West, similar to what occurred in Somalia, but with the added concern that it possesses oil and is closer to Europe. President Obama is hosting a counterterrorism summit at the White House aimed at strengthening and coordinating efforts against extremists. Representatives of more than 60 countries and several major U.S. cities are attending. The three-day meeting is highlighting domestic and international efforts to prevent extremist groups from inspiring and radicalizing individuals, both in the United States and abroad. VOA's Mohammed Elshenawy spoke with David Ottaway, a senior scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington, about the roots of violent extremism.
With the well-known roots of Islamist radicalism, what's needed to prevent the potential creation of another ISIS in the region?
All the governments, Arab governments, have to deal with economic issues now. If they can't provide the jobs, there are going to be real problems ahead. And I think they realize this. Certainly the Saudis do. Certainly every government's talking about trying to get the economy going and creating more jobs. But it is very complicated, and they're being overwhelmed by hundreds of thousands of graduates coming out of the universities that expect jobs, and they're not getting them. So I think it's a race against time. Whether or not the governments can figure out how to absorb this unemployment and provide jobs. And if they can't, then you're going to have a whole generation of college, university-educated, angry people that willing to go out on the streets.
So what's your prescription for a strategy to fight the hateful ideology of ISIS and prevent it from winning young Muslim hearts and minds?
I think the Americans have no role. It's the governments and the Muslim governments, Arab governments, that have to take care of that issue. And that Americans cannot tell the Arab world or the Muslim world about how moderates should combat extremists. That is up to the Muslim Arab governments in the region to fight that battle.
Why do you think moderate Islamists in the Middle East were sidelined while militants are having the upper hand in the region?
Well, they were. If we take Egypt, they were sidelined because they mishandled their time in office. I'm talking about Mohamed Morsi and Muslim Brotherhood. Because with the Salafis, they had control of, they had 70% of the seats in parliament, and they tried to go it alone rather than build an alliance with secular parties. And this, you know, set off a violent reaction, political reaction, and to the extent that millions of people got out on the street and encouraged the military to take over. So that's what happened in Egypt. In the Maghreb, you see, the Maghreb, they're much more politically sophisticated, at least one part of the Islamist tendency. They're willing to get involved. They're willing to make political compromises, which is part of the political process. And they've had a long experience now, particularly in Algeria, with the benefits and the liabilities of being part of a government. The PJD in Morocco is now going through that experience, you know, the benefits and the liabilities of being in the government. But this is an important experience. Islamists have to learn that they can't have the whole cake. They've got to learn how to cooperate with secular parties, or they're not going to get anything. And so what is encouraging about the Maghreb is that, to my mind, they're learning this. You know, you don't always get your way. So then you go in the opposition, but then you have elections and you try and convince people. That's exactly what should happen.
David Ottaway, a senior scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington. John Sutherland, a senior analyst with the Department of Defense and author, examines a new face of war. It's the eye gorilla. We asked him what that is.
What the eye gorilla is a new technological psychologically competent insurgent. Really kind of the way I think about it is all the way up until 2000 when I thought about guerrillas, I would think of like Che Guevara and his band of guerrillas running around the backwoods of Bolivia wearing worn-out old fatigues and carrying AK-47s. Not very technically competent, not a lot of good equipment with them, and they eventually were hunted down and defeated not really too hard. The modern eye guerrilla is much better equipped, and they're technically competent. It's a generational thing. When I thought of the term eye guerrilla, it was kind of like iPod, iPad, you know, iPhone, because it's a younger generation that are competent with the new social media, and they put all these things to work. And so when you see eye guerrillas now, like, say, the Islamic State, these guys aren't wearing, you know, worn-out old stuff. They're in Gucci new ninja outfits and carrying top-of-the-line equipment. And it's all because they've exploited the post-Cold War globalization situation.
How does this change the way we have conflicts in the world?
Well, it makes the perhaps the most important thing that I've noticed about them is guerrillas in the past were not very adaptive. They pretty much had their set way of doing things. But today's guerrillas, they adapt and innovate and change with the forces that are opposing them. And the reason this was is because back in the old days, guerrillas had to form in physical cells. If you take, like, the Algerian guerrillas that fought the French back in the 50s, a cell would form with a small number of folks in it. They would have a certain mission, and they would know each other in their cell and their boss. And their boss would know the next guy in the chain of command, and that was it. So the whole insurgency was compartmentalized, and it helped them to survive. But as you rolled up a cell, if you could get the boss to link you to the next cell, you could roll the thing up gradually, which is how the French defeated them. Well, eye guerrillas organized as a virtual network. They don't have to see each other. They don't have to be in the same group or even in the same city. So they can actually share their lessons learned. When something goes well, they can spread the news on what worked. And when something fails, they can spread that word as well. So a Chechen guerrilla can share a successful bombing technique with somebody in Libya who could share it with somebody in Iraq or Syria. And that makes them much more adaptive. So the fight is a lot more dynamic now.
Author and senior analyst with the Defense Department, John Sutherland. He stresses that his views are his own, not the government's. We plan on bringing you more of his remarks Thursday on International Edition.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. VOAnews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. VOAnews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Bad publicity about martial law, backpacker killings, and police shakedowns of foreigners have harmed Thailand's reputation as a tourist magnet in past months. As VOA correspondent Steve Herman in Bangkok reports, the tourism industry for 2015 is trying to attract more upscale visitors, as well as package tourists from China, who are spending more per day than other nationalities.
From the hawkers on the Phuket beach to the managers in five-star Bangkok hotels, about 1 in 10 Thais holds a job related to tourism. The sector suffered last year amid political tension with long-term street protests in Bangkok that culminated with a military coup. Martial law remains in effect. That and publicity overseas about tourists being victims of serious crimes on resort islands, police shaking down foreigners in the capital, and taxi drivers overcharging fares have combined to give many potential tourists second thoughts about visiting. At Bangkok's Dusit Thani Hotel, a five-star establishment dating back to 1970, General Manager Sukanya Janchu says the tourism sector has always managed to quickly bounce back from crises brought about by natural disasters, political troubles, or economic downturns.
We challenge with nearly all crises we have. We learn from that. It's one after the other. It's quite challenging, but we always able to manage it pretty well.
Known as the Land of Smiles, Thailand hopes to put a happy face on the sector again this year and greet 28 million visitors, which was the numerical goal last year. In 2014, the total number of actual visitors was 26 million. But the goal for 2015 is not just a numerical target. Varatorn Sirisatayawang, an analyst at the Kasikorn Research Center, says Thailand this year will try to move away from its image as a backpacker's haven.
The government agenda, we try to attract the more quality tourists more than quantity in many tourist destinations. We also have the place for the middle group to the high-end tourists who get all north and Chiang Mai. We have a hotel like five-star up and also the niche market, healthcare, spa and things like that.
Sukanya Jancho, who is also the marketing and public relations chairperson for the Thai Hotels Association, says the transition upmarket is not going to be achieved quickly or easily.
To drive from mass one is quite a challenge, but I think it can be done. Maybe it takes longer time, but we have to start.
China is now the largest single source of visitors to Thailand. The Chinese are considered the best spenders per capita on a daily basis, but their growing influence is not without controversy. During this week's Chinese New Year period, with 90,000 visitors from China expected, many are receiving etiquette guides. The brochures explain how to behave in museums and at temples, encourage proper rules for driving, and warn against public property as toilets. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is vowing to protect complete religious freedom in his country. The assurance comes amid criticism that his government has been slow in responding to a spate of attacks on Christian institutions and thwart efforts by hardline affiliate Hindu groups to convert religious minority groups. From New Delhi, Anjana Pasricha reports.
Speaking at an event organized by the Christian community in New Delhi to celebrate the beatification of two Indians, Prime Minister Narendra Modi strongly condemned violence targeting religious minorities and vowed to protect them.
My government will act strongly in this regard. With this commitment, I appeal to all religious groups to act with restraint, mutual respect, and tolerance in the true spirit of this ancient nation.
Mr. Modi's comments were seen as a bid to reassure religious minorities amid criticism that his government, led by the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, has not done enough to stem religious tensions that have surfaced since it came to power last May. India is predominantly Hindu, but it has 160 million Muslims and a small proportion of Christians. In recent weeks, there have been five attacks on churches in New Delhi, described as vandalism and arson attacks. That led to community concerns about a deliberate campaign of violence and intimidation. Community leaders led a protest saying they feel unsafe. Controversy has also been triggered by a series of religious conversion ceremonies sponsored by hardline Hindu groups in recent months to welcome back hundreds of Muslims and Christians into Hinduism. Mr. Modi has been sharply criticized for remaining silent on the issue. His slow response has also raised concerns about the Hindu nationalist leaders' ability to control extremist Hindu groups. But on Tuesday, the Indian leader spoke up forcefully for religious freedom, saying India will remain secular.
My government will ensure that there is complete freedom of faith and that everyone has the undeniable right to retain or adopt the religion of his or her choice without coercion.
Prime Minister Modi's appearance at the event organized by the Christian community was seen as a bid to reach out to minorities. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On February 18th, 1229, during Europe's Sixth Crusade, Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II signed an alliance with the Sultan of Egypt, giving Frederick control of Jerusalem. However, Muslims regained the city in 1244. On this day in 1546, Martin Luther died. Luther was the founder of the Protestant Reformation. His teachings challenged the theology and practices of the Roman Catholic Church and set in motion forces that had a big influence on the development of Western civilization. In 1564, Italian Renaissance artist Michelangelo died. Michelangelo's greatest works were almost all in service of the Christian Church, including a large statue of King David and a spectacular painting on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in Rome. In 1885, Mark Twain's novel, Huckleberry Finn, was first published in the United States. Written as a sequel to an earlier novel, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, Twain, whose real name was Samuel Clemens, focused on life in the American South. American physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer died on this date in 1967. He is best known as the director of the Manhattan Project during World War II, the secret program to build an atomic bomb. In 1970, a group of anti-war protesters known as the Chicago Seven were found not guilty of conspiracy in a trial that resulted from a riot at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Five of the seven were found guilty of crossing state lines to incite a riot. The violence was believed to be a factor in the victory of Republican candidate Richard Nixon in the 1968 elections. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The surest way to pull people out of poverty is to provide them with an education. In fact, according to the World Bank, education is one of the most powerful instruments for reducing poverty and inequality, and lays a foundation for sustained economic growth. For every extra school year completed, a worker's earnings increase by 10%. It is no wonder, then, that some of the poorest countries in the world also have the highest levels of illiteracy, particularly among women. So, for example, 73% of the adult population of South Sudan is illiterate, and fewer than half of school-aged children were enrolled in school last year. Only 3 in 10 secondary students are girls. This is partly due to the ongoing conflict in South Sudan. Some 1,200 schools have closed in the most conflict-affected states, while 90 schools are occupied by fighting forces or internally displaced persons. On top of that, about 400,000 children have dropped out due to the crisis. Increasing access to education is an important part of the United States strategy to eliminate extreme poverty. That is why the United States currently supports 6 education projects in South Sudan, worth more than $165 million. The newest of these is a partnership between the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and BRAC, the world's largest non-governmental development organization. The partnership aims to provide quality basic education to children in South Sudan who are currently not attending school. Established in Bangladesh in 1971, BRAC has been extraordinarily successful in pulling people out of poverty in Bangladesh and in 10 other countries. The NGO works by empowering the poor and creating opportunities for them, largely through education. The United States is committed to helping South Sudan and its people thrive, and we believe that improving access to quality education for the country's children will go a long way toward reaching that goal. The children of today are the potential leaders of this country tomorrow, said U.S. Chargé d'Affaires Ambassador Charles Twining. The United States is proud to help ensure that South Sudan's children achieve that potential to lead this country tomorrow.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.